It's June 16th. Your leader will be Dwayne Addison. And continuing our series on Native American spirituality, our concern today will be life is sharing. Again today, I want to make some affirmations, share some material with you, and that will move into sort of sharing and discussion of ourselves in terms of our own experiences and interpretations of these things. Let's begin again with silence before we move into these concerns. Lord, enable us to hear and to learn and to share. Amen. Welcome. Of the topics I've sort of put together in terms of Native American spirituality, this is the one that's sort of most interesting to me for a variety of reasons. One, I guess, because it deals with very contemporary and very close things that talk about human relationships, the area that informs ethics, the own discipline that I am trained in, lifestyle, human relationships. Also, I think it is important because this is the one that is sort of most real to me in terms of my own relationships today among Indian people. The things I'll be talking about today are very much alive. One of the things that the dominant society has not been able to suppress, they've tried to, and our church has been a part of that. Our culture has been a part of that. The thing that I'll talk about in terms of sharing. And the person that I'll draw from most to share these is a woman now dead, Ella DeLoria. You may know the name of DeLoria. That's a whole family, particularly from the Dakotas. You'll recognize the name. She has a nephew, Vine DeLoria Jr., who's written one of the most gifted Indian writers, who writes with a bitter satire and writes primarily for non-Indian people and will inform you of a lot of things. I know of no modern writer in any field with which I disagree more and probably have not learned more from him. But Ella DeLoria is more gentle. She comes from a Christian perspective. Her father and many of the people in DeLoria family were a tradition of spiritual leaders in the Dakota, this branch of the Sioux community. And they became, for several generations, some of the leaders within the Christian community among the Sioux, including her father and her brother and some others in the family. She herself, a very adult, devout Episcopalian, but very appreciative of the traditional ways, which is not often the case in those who are converted to Christianity. She became a very noted anthropologist and linguist, working with the language, and her work, you know, in a very gentle sort of way reflects that knowledge. Also worked for many years with the YWCA in terms of its work among Indian, YWCA, and its work among Indian people. In 1944, she wrote a very small book, a very popular one that I would regard as a classic. It's recently been republished, called Speaking of Indians. And that's the material that I refer primarily because it is looking back at that time of these features of the lifestyle. And she very deliberately says, I'm speaking of my own people and their traditions and their ways, but as far as possible, she says, I think this represents many of the Native American peoples in our country. Obviously an apology or a plea to understand and to learn. Let me share several brief affirmations and then illustrate this from Ella DeLoria and make some transitional comments, and then we'll share. What are the meanings of this, both for our understandings of Native peoples today, relationships, but also for insights into our Christian faith itself? Again, common features of Native American life, although my illustrations will be primarily from the Sioux. In her case, she'll speak about the Dakota, one of the language divisions of the Sioux. These things that you'll find again and again. Three affirmations. There is a sense of community that includes the person as a member of the family, of the tribe, of the people. first of all, you perceive yourself not as an individual, as we've sort of learned in our culture and sort of modern Christianity, but you are a part of those larger communities. And if we had time here, but I will not do it, there is a particular view of the family and the Plains Indian people, the extended family. And maybe our ancestors have come from that too, from Europe or wherever we have come from. And so that's not just sort of a property of Indian people, but it is that family that is very large and very important. It is a fundamental structural unit. And your identity is bound up with that community. And you learn from the earliest childhood that you are a part. I will come to some of the affirmations that are on the blackboard or on the board here that sort of illustrate these sorts of things. A second one, and these are really different ways of speaking about the same realities. Among most Native American peoples, there is a spirit of generosity, and that's the one I'll hit the hardest. A spirit of generosity that honors sharing above accumulating. Your identity as a person, your worth as a person, is to share, to give. But sharing, I think, is a better word here, and we'll come back to that in strength. A third affirmation, again, speaks of some of the same things. We find very often a cooperative lifestyle does not count success as defeating others. You do not see yourselves in these traditional societies, and it still continues today, as competing. At Augustana College, I share teaching Indian studies. I'm the junior partner in that area with a Lakota Indian person named Martin Brokenleg. I've adapted some of these things, but he teaches his classes, and contrary to the modes of education, he puts them in groups, and the word is teoshpie, and that's the extended family. And to understand, if you understand that concept, you've understood most of Native American life and religion, he thinks. I think he's, you know, on the right track. In which that group, throughout the whole course, is a unit, and they do some of the things that the traditional teoshpie, or family unit, did, including getting their grades. And so the grade that you get is what the unit gets. And so you learn to cooperate that. And every time he does this, I get a stream of the students coming to me and that, and sort of, you undo this because they don't do it because somebody else is not pulling their weight, because our deep values of competing against one another, and it's very much built into a liberal arts college like Augustana College, that you win by getting better grades than somebody else, and that comparison that's there. Most of the Indian students that are in our class love it. You know, this is the way we do it. And that is both an opportunity and a problem in education among Indian young people at school level, that you have to take very great care that you do not overshadow the other ones. You do not compete to get their head, and at least you do not do this openly and publicly. And so that has some lessons there in terms of pedagogy. And so the problems are there. These three things, that sense of community, that spirit of generosity, that lifestyle that is non-competitive. You know, I can find exceptions to this. I've watched Indian basketball and so forth, and I see nothing quite as competitive as this. And some seeming exceptions there, but maybe you want to pick that up. And what's intriguing about these things, all of those elements are alive today. Maybe in varied forms, maybe in twisted forms, and destructive forms. But I've discovered, I first came into the Indian, non-Indian sorts of things and the concern for justice, that fellow human beings were not getting their fair shake. And I was introduced to what I call lifestyle, ways of life and values and attitudes that I found very instructive. I found this sense of hospitality, almost unmatched by other cultures. Whether it's on the reservation or Indian families in Sioux Falls or working with Native American Christian communities, because these values are very much alive there. Then again, I look at the history, some exceptions to this, but generally that spirit of welcoming, including, and sharing for the outsider is deeply built in so many of the cultures, particularly true of the Plains. Let me sort of put this in concrete forms, and I think very beautiful way, in the way Ella DeLoria, this woman of the Dakotas, speaking very obviously in a kind of a Christian apology, but also apology for her own people. Well, she'll talk here about the whole identity of being a Dakota, that language division of the Sioux of which she herself has come, and how it comes about. So let me share several of these things. It'd be largely quotes, a little commentary, and I hope I've kept the continuity of these things. And that part of her book, it's a very sort of a poignant book because it's a feeling of pain. And that major part of the book, the second part, she says, a scheme of life that worked. She's looking back on this and the remnants of this, but it is a scheme or way of living that has difficulty making its way in the present world. It is beautiful, it is good, it is right, but she also later on talks about the difficulties and the kind of adaptation that may be necessary for her people. And that phrase I shared yesterday that talked about relating to the environment and the earth really comes out of the social context of which I want to zero in on today. Kinship was the all-important matter. Its demands and its dictates for all phases of social life were relentless and exact. She'll go on and say later, it is not a burden, it is an opportunity. But on the other hand, its privileges and honorings and rewarding prestige were not only tolerable, but downright pleasant and desirable for all who conformed. By kinship, all Dakota people were held together in a great relationship that was theoretically all-inclusive, coextensive with the Dakota domain. Later she'll talk about that, and I think I illustrated that in part, or comes in that setting. When Christianity came, her argument is that that was extended beyond the people to include all people, even the enemy. I think she has some truth in that matter. Everyone who was born in Dakota belonged in it. Nobody need to be left outside. This meant that the Dakota camp circles, and it was symbolized by the geography and the shape of the building and the circles, were no haphazard assemblages of heterogeneous individuals. Ideally, nobody living there was unattached. If you had deviant behavior, if you were the rascal, if you're young or old or someplace, there was a place within that circle, and the circle is important. A few lines later, the ultimate aim of Dakota life, and she goes on to illustrate how ritual and just about everything prepares one, so from the moment almost of your birth. The ultimate aim of Dakota life, stripped of accessories, was really quite simple. One must fulfill kinship rules. One must be a good relative. No Dakota who has participated in that life will dispute that. In the last analysis, every other consideration was secondary. Property, and we'll talk about that. Personal ambition, glory, good times, and even life itself. The fundamental ethic was being a good relative. Kinship was the important thing. And then to continue, this need of first establishing proper relationship prevailed even when one came to pray. Indeed, this is a spiritual matter, a matter of the spirit of the heart of the values and the perceptions. It gave one status with the supernatural as well as with human beings. The Dakota words to address a relative and to pray are very familiar words in our culture. And in terms of their roots, the source from which they come, she discovered somewhat later in life, when she'd done her linguistic study, I discovered that they're really one. Wachikia, and she used the term here, means really both acts in its proper context. And that shouldn't be surprising, come to think of it, for a Dakota did not like to deal with another person without first avowing his own status with the another person, and without first avowing the relationship, the kind of relative that this was. And that would include the duties that were incumbent upon him or her, and while reminding the other of his. I think I shared yesterday, because it comes from the social context, my friend Martin Broken Leg talks about if someone comes to his door and gives the Lakota, or the Dakota word for cousin, he says, we are utterly helpless, because we learned here that there are appropriate ways to respond. And even if he doesn't prove it, you take that word here And obviously, if the word has appearance of being an Indian, well, he probably is your cousin in some way, in the meaning of that, and you must respond. That's not a good thing, because another parenthetical thing, I had a number of Indian people, but a very good friend of mine, that he moved to Sioux Falls, and he had an unlisted number, and I was one of a handful of people it became necessary to have his number, and very restrictions around that, because if that number were available, he would have been devastated. The Indian people that would come in would naturally expect that he, having his things, would share it. And he knew that if he had opened his door, you know, the people would come in. And that's part of the problem of a scheme that worked and does not work, seem to work now. We'll come back to that. But that wachikia, addressing relatives, is the same word used when you smoke the pipe. To smoke the pipe ceremonially in terms of prayer is wachikia. And then a few other notes. Of relatives only might you be sure that you can have conversation, relationships, a sense of trust. And so it became necessary in our society to first make relatives of erstwhile strangers. And one of the most important ceremonies I could describe here from Black Elk or from the Sacred Pipe, that if a stranger came into the community, it became very important before you do anything with them that you bring them into the kinship pattern, that he had to be a relative. And then and only then could you relate to them. You know, you obviously didn't make the crow of the enemy people that, but very often, and the typical story is that white people, European Americans, came in, and most especially spiritual ones, priests, pastors, when they became very important because they had powers and in touch with powers, would be welcome within the community. Why not? We follow the line of argument. Thus, kinship had everybody in a fast net of interpersonal responsibility and made everyone like it. Why? Because its rewards were most pleasant. And she gives illustrations here about conflict and the amazing power of conflict management to remind them that you were a Dakota or a Lakota. Peace is implied by the very name of our people, O Dakota. With an O in front of that, or O Lakota for the other dialect division, is a state or a condition of peace. The O is the locative prefix indicating the place. And the elders would say, we Dakotas love peace within our borders. Peacemaking is our heritage, and it has to do with the family. Even as children, we settled our little fights through kinship that we might live O Dakota, that we might be Dakota people. Such an appeal in kinship's name was supreme. It placed the responsibility for one's relatives' peace and their peace of mind, and particularly squarely on the troubled one. It reminded him or her that no Dakota lived unto himself alone. All were bound together in kinship. One might not rightly ask, pardon my, and this is, I think, is important, one might not rightly risk even his or her own life needlessly. It isn't that sort of sense of bravado. Thereby bringing tears to the eyes of one's relatives, especially, and most especially, one's sisters and one's women cousins, to whom the man owed the very highest respect and consideration. Therefore, he must remain alive and he does not risk himself unnecessarily. For however slightly he might value himself, he must regard the relatives supremely. And going on much illustrative material, a few other notes, summary of this sort of concern. First, the Dakota said, be a good relative. That is of paramount importance. And then he would say, be related somehow to everyone you know. Make him or her important to you. So the stranger must become the relative. But then, seeing that some people were still left out, former relationships with them were manufactured through a social kinship system. And the early travelers talked about these and were amazed by these sorts of arrangements. An ingenious method of including everyone, you know, except the enemies here, they are the exceptions, but for including everyone and the great circle of relatives. and then? And then the Dakota would say, be generous. But how unnecessary that would be to say that. Would anyone withhold that which is good from himself for one's very own? Be hospitable. Well, why not, we would say. Should a man eat while his brother starves? Certainly not. With such unuttered reasoning, the Dakotas fitted every detail of existence together as into a neat mosaic to make their own particular scheme of life that worked. And again, notice she puts it in the past tense. To explore that concept of sharing, the one I want to deal with most especially, a few more notes. How does that relate to what we call the economics? Economics, of course, has to do with the household, whether the narrow one or the one writ large. And that's where we picked it up in the folklore, perhaps romantically, but the roots are here. In the section which he picks it up, economics is the idea of giving to have. Still, I would suggest, very much alive. Personal experience, anthropological studies that are there. Giving was glorified and the formal giveaway. If you've never seen one of these or an aspect of that, I invite you to it because it's a common occurrence today. Was a bona fide Dakota institution. And footnote, it was banned many times by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, educational institutions, sometimes by the encouragement of the church itself as sort of being stupid, destructive. We've coined the phrase Indian giving as our misunderstanding of that idea. And just, again, another footnote. There's another meaning to Indian giving if you go to the tribes of the Northwest coast, some of it in Washington, but mainly in the British Columbia coast, connected with the Potlatch. And it's a different setting, some connections, but something different that I want to lift up here. But the giving. Pride, identity, one's meaning, lay in honoring relatives rather than in amassing goods for oneself. So if someone made you a gift, no matter how valuable it might be, he did not mean for it to grow old along with you. He expected you to use it when and as you chose, but you must do it, when and as you chose to honor someone else, maybe not back to you, and indirectly yourself. He gave with the expectation as much as to say, I have owned this for some time. You own it next. And then when you wish to make a gift, pass it on. And she illustrates this with a marvelous story of George Catlin, the painter that lived among several Plains tribes back there, and was sort of intrigued by this fact of that thing. And you know, I can find experience of this too, but he honored, I think, were some moccasins that were trimmed on that, and he looked at it, and he just said that he thought that. And when Catlin was leaving that tribe, and they knew that he was not to be back, probably forever to that, just as he was leaving, the friend to whom he'd made this sort of comment of admiration of those moccasins had a tightly bundled package, and as the boat left, he threw it on the boat on that, and so he'd have to unbind that and no way of coming back in there, and it was him. And he had admired it, it was his. And of course, he would have expected to share it with others and to pass it along. But he did not expect to give it back. I have items of Indian jewelry, a beautiful medallion of beaded sort of things. And you should be very careful. And we joke about it, too, because if you admire it, you know, you might get it or something very much like that. But of course, the idea is that you should be willing to pass along and to give that to others as well. Okay. Let me wind this up very quickly. That idea of ownership. There was little pride in ownership of goods. Anthropologists may say this is a very nomadic society, that you couldn't do this. What good would it have much anyway, because you can't cart it with you when you're on the move most of the time. Little pride in ownership of goods, but much pride in ownership. And the ownership of relatives. If you wish to honor me publicly, you do not load me down personally with presents. The better way to honor me was to give a gift in my name. You made someone else glad in my name, as though I were doing the giving. And that is, and that is where the honor lay for me. It brought three, the giver, the recipient, and especially me. All of us received honor. And then a summary note, all that I've been describing here in this part, that is a scheme of life that worked, concerns of life that went on before the white man came among the Dakotas. Yet I have personally observed enough of the vestiges, and really more than vestiges, of it still remaining to accept without question the accounts of it that have come down to us. And then she goes on, but I will not share how this sort of system, which is based on reciprocity, that you're in a community that honors the value of honoring and sharing, and which the society does not, you know, return it. But yet, in a variety of ways, it is continued. On the board, I put several quotes that keep coming to my mind, and several names. I bet you Marie Sondeau is as well. Live to give, not to gain. Or various ways is a theme that's put forth. Or she speaks much more, and I didn't really touch upon this. No Dakota starves alone. It's unheard of in the traditional societies, and in a sense, it's unheard of even though there's a great deal of starvation. It may be the whole family or the extended family that sort of starves. That if you have it, and I've experienced this so many times, if you come, what they have is yours, and it may almost be nothing. It is automatically that whatever it is, we will share. And the footnote that I would add, even if that is alcohol, you know, that is a very destructive thing. I have friends, many Indian friends, where alcohol has overpowered them, and they go back into their old community. This kind of an expression of that virtue of sharing is over more powerful than the care here, at least we would think so. And so whether the person is alcoholic or not, you offer them the gift, and the pressures here of being part of the community are so strong. One of the reasons that the typical alcohol programs and the patterns of the AA are not very effective, because they're not culturally specific to Indian people, and that's just one of the concerns that is there. Not ownership, but honorship. I've already illustrated this, or Ella DeLoria has. The possessions are there to give honor, and honor to everybody within that connection that is there. And then each one is responsible for all. That I'm a part of that community. I put down the name of Marie Sandoz. Some of you may know her as a very prolific author of Nebraska and that Western Nebraska, and many of her books dealing with Indian concerns as well as immigrant concerns. And she has a little children's book that I think is another masterpiece. Very simple. These were the Sioux. In very simple language, she talks about these values here, and it is really a book about child rearing. And thinking of the values of the child rearing in that community, but she affirms or underlines the note that you learn from the beginning that my life is here is for the sake of the community and its well-being. In a variety of ways, traditionally and still, she suggested she wrote this book, you know, almost a generation ago, that each is responsible for the well-being of the whole. These notes, and then our sharing. A scheme of life that worked. Again, these themes that I put here. That was in the past. The Indian people have moved for a long time now, in which the dominant society has other values. And if you're the only one that shares, you know, and it is not reciprocated, or other Indians do not reciprocate that in various ways, it seems to break down. The society in which competition is a thing, I illustrate this from Martin Brokenleg's classes on that. It's an awful, tough battle to make in which each one is trying to make it as an own in comparison with the others. And success is by competition, the whole idea of making it. What do you do with Indian enterprise? All sorts of tragic stories that I have. I work with the National Indian Lutheran Board, and part of their work is to provide seed money and assist getting seed money for enterprise or Indian projects, and some of these are sort of, preparing things. And one group in Minnesota, beautifully skilled pottery that they could sell, you know, in markets around the world, particularly in the East Coast here, as good property. But the people there make the pottery for just for the sake of making it. And they've not been able successfully there to do it here, and so they have enough to deal the market that is there and to be productive. And I imagine some sort of compromise is necessary there, but that story happens again and again. You produce enough here to make money and do it, the whole part of our Protestant ethic and necessary for free enterprise, difficult to come by in the Indian community because the labor here is just for the thing in itself and not to get return. You have enough money, that's enough return. And that's a part of these values. In fact, when we've shared these things, I teach a lot of teachers that go out for education. And a very frequent response when we talk about these lifestyles of sharing is to say, how dumb, how stupid, you know. How naive can you be? You just are not sane here if you sort of give what you have. The idea is you'd keep it and build it up and protect what you have. But at the same time, there's another set of responses, that a sense of awe. Students say, boy, this sounds awfully familiar. These are some of the things that are talked about in the Sermon on the Mount. These are some of the ideas that seem awfully familiar with Paul's concept of the body, which is the Christian community, of sharing, of building up, of honoring others. And they turn to those passages, and an amazing sort of similarity of the language. And here we have sort of values that are produced before the coming of Christianity, and the connection to be there. And the Christian community, if we look at the story of the book of Acts, had a hard time making it into the world too. So that may be very instructive. I could talk, but I will not, about certain rites that illustrate this, of bringing in the outsider, bringing in the enemy, a concern to reconcile. And so we've given the name of that instrument, the pipe, the peace pipe. And one of the functions of the pipe here is the instrument of reconciliation. And the ceremonies associated with it in a variety of ways in a variety of Indian communities to bring people together to make peace where there was disharmony before. These notes I wish to share. Any questions about this? But to lead on finally, what sort of learning would come to us from this? Insights for our own life, or insights for understanding and relating to Indian people today?
I have a comment on that particularly, but I have a question.
Yeah, please.
Just actually an observation. First of all, the formal giving you were talking about, what was that an annual thing or just something that happened whenever? When you were saying was banned by the Indian Board of Affairs, or is that just this?
Well, the giveaway was associated with almost everything. It came in communities when you had a son who was going off into the military or leaving the community or coming back, the family would do it, or the family particularly blessed in some sort of way. The most common and continuing form of the giveaway is concerned with the loss, the death of one. And that would be completed usually about a year later after the period of grieving on that in which things would be given away. It happens now very frequently. When a person dies, particularly a person that's sort of a long-standing in the community, a very valuable one, you would come to that and a part of the memorial service, we would say. And the biggest part is the giveaway. Their possessions and other things specially created for that would be given away.
Well, it seems like that would be one of the values that we could learn from. I know it's very hard just to give away some clothes that I never wear. And
yeah.
Become more just flexible in giving away like that. I remember reading one book by, just a short story by a woman called Mountain Wolf Woman, I think. When she got married, she gave away all her clothes. They took all the clothes. And then you think, oh my gosh. But then everybody brought things to her, so it looks like
there
was no problem.
And some good stories, you give away practically everything, that sort of practical value. And you know, as she suggests here, that, there's no problem. You're not going to be left destitute because others will share. And the most precious gifts, the most beautiful gifts, are often given to those in need. Your immediate relatives, those close to you, are the ones that are sort of ineligible to get these sorts of things. So in our case, when somebody dies, it's the immediate relatives, the in-laws, that scramble for that. And they're not the ones to receive it, but others that are there. In fact, the in-laws and the closer relatives should also be giving at that time. Yeah.
To what degree is this concept of sharing a common denominator or thread throughout the American Indian tradition, or is it more common in the Dakota tradition, and if so, why?
Yeah. Variations of this are very common in many traditions. And the illustrations here, and I did wear that when I take that, are in the Plains people. Somewhere, I think it's because it may be a nomadic type of existence traditionally, a kind of democracy that exists in that arrangement that has become so central and so strong. But the idea of the various things of generosity and hospitality are frequent ones that are there. I say that because I did make the exclusion, and on the Northwest tribes, like the Kwaikutl and I forget all the names here, that are on the Northwest coast, the potlatch, as it's called, is, I think, something quite different. But I think it's strongest in the plain.
I think you see the same thing on the East Coast Indians that were there. But another point I was wondering about, when you consider Native American spirituality, they have a tremendous spiritual tradition from which we can learn as Christians an awful lot about in terms of their conceptualization of God. Now, is this life of sharing concept something that can be traced to their spirituality or their response to that which they don't understand in terms of a God concept, or is it more really rooted in their nomadic culture and really the necessity of life? In order to survive as a nation, yeah, they had to share.
Yeah. I would say yes to all these things. I think it's very difficult to separate these things because your concept of God is very much connected with survival on, you know, the nomadic way of life and on the plains. And Martin Broken Leg Taylor, if you look at any of the sort of the ethics or the precepts, you can understand them best as a way of survival that sort of fit the people.
You see this in a sense really in our early colonialization of America. You had the people coming over with their strong English backgrounds, coming mm-hmm. from established communities, but once they got over here in the James River area, the Potomac area, the Chesapeake area, and so on, they were forced into a very similar situation. The early Quaker
right.
church, they had to share in order to survive. You had to let your neighbor in, you had to share your wood, you had to share your corn, you had to do this, you had to do self-protection, and so forth. Otherwise, we never would have made it.
Yeah. And there are stories, perhaps somewhat romanticized, both in New England and then in Virginia, that these people, the early colonists, would not have survived without the hospitality of the Native peoples. And the more traditional pattern is that they were welcomed in, so the stranger was there. And in the long run, it proved destructive because you had different concepts of property on there, and the Indian people would allow their friends to share the same sort of property, but that did not work. And the pattern repeats itself that the Indian people would have to move out, the conflict would come. But I think the other point you're suggesting that when Europeans came here, that they adapted very similar values. You have to share in order to survive. And the idea here that the very profound spiritual idea is that the idea of God is bound up that all things, we talked about this earlier, are related. And the very concept of the spirit of these sort of things in that context of the family. And so, indeed, this idea of sharing is not simply a mundane thing, but it is deals with the core understanding of reality.
To what it appears as though you do quite a bit of work with, you say that the Lutheran Church and sponsoring Indian groups for getting small industry started in this
country. Yeah, it's sort of a self-help, grantsmanship thing.
And working with that, have you come up with any opinion as to whether or not the federal protectionism that we have provided the American Indian has really done more harm than good in order for he himself to adapt to what is necessary today, like we say, the alcoholic who needs to be helped, but because of his tradition, goes back and his own people, rather than saying, you need help, no, we'll share, we'll give you more alcohol. Mm-hmm. Well, in providing a reservation protectionism type of policy, are we doing more harm to the Indian today? Are we really sort of ringing the death knell for him, or should we be trying to disseminate him more into our culture so that he can, in fact, can be successful?
Yeah. I'll add some comments, but maybe some others can speak to me with interest too.
I think that's a real good question. Well,
from what I've seen of the association with the Indian school, we have a large Indian school at my hometown, and the students there, the majority of them, when they're at school, they accept everything the way we are living, our lifestyle and everything. But a lot of them, once they graduate and go back to the reservation, they slip right back into their old. And it's kind
of frustrating.
You live
in a different world, yeah.
You look at other.
So I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, but mm-hmm. you look at other strong cultures, particularly your Oriental cultures, whose tradition, sharing, family ties,
the family thing is very similar, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Go back eons, long before Christianity had mm-hmm. And yet their ability to adapt in other geographic areas and other ethnic capabilities so that they can succeed themselves but still maintain their identity as an ethnic group.
Mm-hmm.
There are many examples of that, that for some reason the Indian has not been able to do. And I don't know if that's because we have a false sense, maybe it's a false sense of guilt, maybe it's a legitimate sense of guilt for the prostitution that the white man brought upon the Indian, historically speaking.
Well, I think great efforts were made to suppress some of these things, very early when the conquest period was over, in terms of education, in terms of religious practice, and efforts to suppress even the giveaway, was something that was sort of unthinkable. And Christians took both sides of that issue, historically speaking. I think a matter of degree, which you have in the Chinese people or the Jewish people, because there you have two groups that, because of these strong senses of family, have maintained to a large extent their identity. Mm-hmm. And Indians, I think, have largely been able to maintain it because we have chosen to put them off in reservations. And that's sort of the setting here. You can be somewhat independent. But on the question about what role to take in the future, I think it's a complicated question. Personally, I would speak at this point. I think this role of protectionism, and the sense of dependency that is there, in the long run, has been very destructive. Because whether it's out of guilt or out of legal requirements or a variety of reasons, it is a paternalistic sort of view. Up until very recently, decisions for Indian people in every area of life were made on the outside. For many generations, that the absolute rule on the reservation was the agency superintendent. But that in most cases was not an Indian, and these decisions were made whatever area of life was sort of made. And a way that helped to maintain the culture, the distinction of the rest of society. And I speak from my own experience with the National Indian Lutheran Board, Lutherans have come into Indian concerns relatively lately and relatively lightly. And perhaps we've learned of these things. And though it's very modest, I think there's a very viable form that the money, for example, that goes in your Indian Concerns Sunday or from other sources that these are matched with, try to maintain the integrity of self-determination. Whatever project they do, Indian people would decide this, they take the risk. There's been some movements in this direction in Indian reservations that the tribal governments make the decisions. They're not made in the regional office or in Washington. But if behind that you have a century or more of dependence, you don't have the habit of making your own decisions, and you can survive perhaps better by depending upon the father in Washington, and do not have the skills to do it, it's a difficult transition to make. I would just sort of, in an oversimplified way, that the more self-determination, if Indians determine their own futures, I think would be the best. that ought to be an element of transition. It will need some encouragement and some support, some getting out of the way. And at least for the time being, I think allowing the reservation system to remain. To completely say you are now forced to go into the modern society and fight, I think, has already been illustrated in the last generation or so, been very destructive to turn that relationship. But that's a complicated issue.
I watched a program on the public station, and it was somewhere in the program they were talking about the fact that the Black Hills were, of course, full of minerals and valuable diamonds or gold or whatnot. And that the government was thinking of taking that away. I don't know. Is that the area? That's the Dakota area.
Well, let me just give you the history of those years in South Dakota as well. The Black Hills were illegally recognized now by the Supreme Court, taken away from the Great Sioux Reservation in 1877 after Little Bighorn and all that sort of stuff. It's all part of that story. And as the Indians people, particularly the Sioux, have not given up their claim to that. And so that the claim has been settled and has also been endorsed by all the way to the Supreme Court. Indian people themselves have not decided what to do with it. And some will want it back, some want to take the money and just use it because we'll never get it back. And some will say, let's work together with others and to preserve the hill, you know, in a spiritual sort of manner, as a place of integrity, though, to not destroy it. And so, in a sense, since it was taken away over a century ago, it has never been recognized legally that it belonged to them. You know, it should have belonged to them, but there's no way that the Black Hills, that I would say, would ever go back to Indian people or Indian control.
We had an interesting experience last year. Of course, we didn't have the opportunity to go into any of their religious background or anything like that, but this was just our observation as we traveled through New Mexico and Arizona in the Canyon District, which is completely Navajo. And it was really interesting that once we got into that area, there was absolutely no white government. It was all the highway patrol, the city patrols, everything was strictly Navajo. And while it is a national monument, as far as our government is concerned, yet it is run by the Navajo people.
And the part of the reservation, yes.
Yes, and the money that is given to the individual Indians, as we were told this anyway, that it goes into like a fund, and then it's doled out by their governing body to the people, and they don't get a big sum to go and splurge it on the weekend, you know, and end up with nothing afterward. They're given so much a month. Where they said in some tribes, all this money is just given to a person or a family or something in a lump sum, and then sometimes they don't spend it very wisely. But it seems like, but yet they allow any tourists or anybody to come in there and travel and enjoy it.
Yeah.
But you can't live in there at all. It's strictly Indians.
You live by their permission,
They live there up on the hill in the one season, and then they're down in their farms in the lower areas in the summer to raise their crops. It's really interesting.
There's been talk about making Navajo reservations to another state because their reservation is much larger than many of our states, and a big chunk of northern Arizona plus some neighboring states. The relationship there has been fairly good because the population is overwhelmingly, you know, Navajo there. Trouble is in my part of the country, in Dakotas and Minnesota and these sorts of things, they go outside of the Southwest. The majority of people in Indian reservations are not Indians. And so you go up into like northern Minnesota and the tourist country, lots of tension because, you know, some places 15% of the people are Indians, and you know, who controls things? And particularly we're going to talk about fishing license or property or things, you know, similar sorts of things in ranching in western South Dakota are problem jurisdictions. I would say it all looks obvious. You can just sort of make contacts and cooperate, but South Dakota has not been very effective in cooperating in our state government and Indian affairs, and that comes from both the Indian and the non-Indian side.
Yeah. Well, I was wondering,
was it only 15% of the reservation were Indian?
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think the Leech Lake Reservation, and I, you know, that's probably the extreme for living in.
Just the people that want to live there?
Well, I mean, among the Indian, yeah, the 15% of the population that lives there, you know, are that. And in places like that, you come into the summer and the tourists, and the tourists probably go three or four times. And,
I see.
And so technically, within those borders, that's Indian reservation. And what do you do? So, you know, they want to gain their money by putting fees on fishing or hunting. You know, in one place in Minnesota, you go up Red Lake Reservation, you have Red Lake automobile license. You're in the territory of Red Lake Reservation. That's not a big tourist area because it's quite remote. The variation of the problem, who controls? And in South Dakota, it really turns out to be a no man's land. You know, sort of vary where you are, that you know, that the laws are not enforced. And you have sort of treatment and continuous hassle about protection. Whether you're on the highways or in protection from, you know, theft or vandalism and so forth. These all sorts of practical problems that have been raised. Or in terms of development of the reservation, tribal governments want to then maintain enough land so that it becomes viable, for example, for ranching. And while you've had several generations of, well, South Dakota and Rosebud Reservation, the people of German ancestry there came there about the same time that the Indians, quote unquote, settled that land, and that was designated their reservation. So the whites have been there as long as the Indian people, you know, as that sort of place. And so now their livelihood is threatened. And lots of inflammatory rhetoric is there, and the situation is there. Probably, you know, as I see it from the Midwest and literally the most volatile spot in terms of Indian white relationship is right in the state of Washington. Anybody here from Washington?
I'm from the area of Puyallup.
Okay, tell us about that.
Well, actually, I haven't, I've been out of state for about 6 years, but one of the years that I was down in Oregon, again and again, we kept hearing down there about the whites, the fishing rights of the Puyallup River for the Indians.
And again, the federal courts have ruled in favor largely of Indian sorts of things, that they have, you know, the legal and traditional right to fight these lands. And declining salmon populations on that, and so it's constant.
Sure, and then it's the same thing. Lots of the white people have been there practically.
Yeah, as long as Indian people.
So they can't understand why they can't make their life with it.
I see the church, and one of the groups here, is sort of being sort of mediating influence to help understand the issues and bring groups together, and then you're caught in the middle. some of these sorts of things.
Getting into a serious problem at times with some of the children when if they're ill, and then there's the thought that perhaps the care isn't adequate, or the rehabilitation care or whatever won't be enough.
Yeah.
And then they're put into foster care, and there's a real struggle there.
That is a very important issue for Indian people. You know, the child care and foster care and adoption and some recent legislation in the late 70s. Came out of this, and strong feeling Indian people that Indian children, first of all, they could be taken care of by the extended family, but that didn't happen, but to take them, you know, raised in the Indian community. And the history of so many Indian people being removed out of that and raised in white homes, but for the best of intentions, and probably better, you know, hygienic and health care than they would in any case.
You still hear frequent TV shorts on, you know, let us keep our own children sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that is a very painful thing. And I have some very close friends that have, you know, been a part of that struggle, Indian people who are trying to gain control of their children, to keep control of their children or grandchildren in these cases.
Yeah, we had one group some years ago who had a presentation at our church, one weekday evening, I remember.
Carol.
Along that line, hasn't there been a tendency at least I think it's probably still going on, but earlier in the century and so forth, where the missions set up schools and then they pulled the children away hundreds of miles from their families because it seemed so important for the missions to educate them, and it was better to do it in one location than to try to scatter the few teachers they had available. The Flandreau School is still going on.
Many of the early schools, the primary method was to have a missionary or church educational institutions, and the primary way, or practically speaking, as well as other reasons, is to put up the boarding school. With rules, typically, that you remove them from the whole year from these schools. They had national Indian schools, by the way. Where they're not allowed to speak their language or do their sort of cultural things. And clearly a part of that operation was to break them from their hold of traditional culture, to keep them away from the, get them away from the blanket, the phrase was. And a strange little bit of history, at least seems strange now, that this was largely paid for and largely supported by the federal government, that they would pay missions because the missions were already in place, they have the know-how, they have the dedicated people, and they were to perform the job of assimilating, or the word then was civilizing the Indian people. And there's a great deal of ill feeling among Indian people about these schools, particularly boarding schools. A very good friend of ours, who has now become a Lutheran, because Lutherans would be better, and a deep Christian piety, just sort of has a deep deal of pain, of hatred. In her case, she was in the Catholic community, and what they've done to destroy her people and herself. And they, you know, they taught us to lie, and they just sort of put us down. And I've heard so many variations of these stories that there are people that, seen in retrospect, that that's been a very painful experience, and the Christian community has been a part of that. So difficult to overcome. Yeah.
Well, once again, down in the Southwest, didn't the Catholics more or less let the Indians keep their own culture?
It depends on which Catholic tradition that is there. In the place of St. Francis, I should knock the Franciscans, but I will. Franciscans that came in, in California, but they also came in the Pueblo communities and so forth. Tried to do a total sort of rooting their people out and destroying the old ways. And so we have among the Pueblo communities either superficial Christianity or largely rejection of it, and a real hostility in the Southwest of Catholic mission there. But if you go down to the Papago Reservation, another Catholic tradition has come along, and everybody in this huge Papago Reservation, they tell me, is nominally a Catholic, but if not nominally so, but Catholicism has blended with the Papago ways, and sort of a synthetic sort of thing. It is like people in northern Mexico there. It continues that the Catholicism under Jesuit influence in that sense, from the very beginning, was adaptable, and they blessed, you know, so-called pagan ways. Now, that's a very complicated question. But you go there and you find Catholicism have attempted to suppress and root out the old ways in order to plant Christianity. Some varieties, like the Jesuits, build upon the foundations that are there, and so you have the whole range of connections to Christian faith and that. Ellen DeLaurie here, she talks about as Episcopalian, and the largest group among Christian Indians in South Dakota are Episcopalians. And she says it's Episcopalian bias, I guess, but she has some misgivings about the more strictly religious practices on that. But the main part of the lifestyle, the gatherings and so forth, she said, fit in so neatly with what the Christian faith was taken that she sees the Christian faith as really enhancing and complementing what was already beautiful that was there. In particular, she talks beautifully about the worship, the color, the ceremony. That these are deeply a part of ritual. The church comes along and brings them together. And so that range of Christianity and Indian things is a whole host of expressions. I see that in working with Native American Christians in these days, and some things that are happening now that could not have happened, you know, even a decade ago, to say that these old ways are beautiful. You know, we look at them somewhat critically, but finally we receive them. The creation stories, the ceremonies that are there, let's be open to them. And that's happening in the Protestant Christian community. I think it's time almost for the bell. Any last comments, and then we will. Thank you. I have one more session I want to share, and I put the title, and maybe misleading, Humor is Sacred. But I particularly want to lift up the central thing, the role of the clown in the Native American traditions is very common, almost universal. To say some other things about worship, and again to see what might be instructive for us, both in understanding Indian people, but and also enriching our own faith. Thanks very much.